Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the IC Interviews podcast. I'm Dan Jones, Deputy Editor of Investors Chronicle. And today I'm joined by Ben Peters and Chris Elliott of Evenload Investment. Ben is the co-founder of equity specialist Evenload, which launched in 2009. He's co-manager of the firm's Evenload Income Fund, which focuses on UK dividend stocks, and is lead manager on the Evenload Global Income Fund. Chris is also a manager on Evenload Global Income, which is now 5 years old. We're going to be talking about the funds today, the stocks they hold, and Ben and Chris's experience of a pretty tricky year for all investors. Ben and Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dan.
How is life in Chipping Norton?
Life's very good, thank you. Yes, the usual sort of winter sniffles are coming along, but otherwise fine, thank you.
We're persevering. Excellent. Well, let's get into it. As I say, it has been a tricky year for investors for any number of reasons. Income investors, though, perhaps have had it a little better than others. How have you found this year dealing with this world we're in of higher inflation, higher interest rates? And specifically, as a starting question, has this year changed your thinking in terms of how you construct portfolios, how you look for investments, things like that? Or is it just a question of applying your process and looking to the long term?
Yeah, I mean, I think in short, it's the latter. But clearly, it's been a very interesting year for all sorts of reasons, macroeconomically, geopolitically, and from the corporate operations point of view. But at Evenload Investment, you know, we have a particular way of investing. We look for particular qualities in companies, and in short, we're looking for companies that are asset light, they're cash generative. They've got good competitive positions, and we do look to invest in them for the long term. So whilst we do evolve the portfolios through time to reflect the changing valuation environment, and sometimes when things change at companies as well, we are fundamentally long-term investors. And so we set the portfolios up to deal with a broad range of economic situations. And this year is but one. We've just come out of the back of 2 years of coronavirus pandemic and the lockdowns there. And you know, there's always something going on. But it's fair to say there's a lot of macro about at the moment.
And looking at the construction of the portfolios, let's start with UK stocks, which are held obviously in Evenload Income, but also in Global Income as well. You know, you're looking for real dividend growth. You're looking for companies with high returns on capital and strong free cash flow. The UK obviously is a tricky market for, you know, investors. A lot of our listeners will be predominantly invested in the UK for obvious reasons in specific stocks. You've got a decent chunk of your global income portfolio in the UK still. Are you finding more opportunities there now? Or maybe you were finding more opportunities at the start of the year. And obviously, UK large caps have had, relatively speaking, a good year. And that's kind of the pool in which you're fishing. What's your take on the UK from a global perspective as dividend investors?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're being global investors, we're relatively agnostic as to where companies are listed. We do have a valuation discipline, and we look to invest in companies when they are good value, and the reflection in the portfolio of UK listed businesses reflects there is some good value to be found in the UK market. We do also have a sort of overweight to European markets as well, where we do see some relatively better value. And actually, a trend for the portfolio over the last 5 years has been to slowly, and we always make changes incrementally unless there's some real good reason to do otherwise. Through time, we've gradually reduced our weighting to the US, and that's not a sort of geographic asset allocation call, but on a company-by-company basis, that's a reflection of where we see relatively better value. And if you look at some of the larger holdings in the portfolio, you'll see Unilever towards the top of the portfolio in terms of the weighting, and that's just a reflection of the relative valuation that we see. But when it comes to dividends and dividend growth, I think the UK has been traditionally viewed as a sort of income-led market. Sometimes that's equated with yield. You know, for us, and as you say, we're very much focused on the potential for companies to grow their dividend through time, which is why we look for these asset-light businesses. So we're looking for those companies. They don't necessarily have the highest yield, but clearly we would like some yield, but where there's an ability to grow. And you can certainly find those across different sectors, even in the UK market, which is a smaller market these days. But, you know, our most recent addition to the portfolio is the credit referencing agency Experian, which happens to be UK listed. Actually, its main business is in the US. So we're much more interested generally in where those companies do business rather than quite where the listing is.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Exactly to that point. If you look at the UK companies in the portfolio, they are very much on the large cap side. So it's really about where they generate their revenues, and that's very international. So Unilever generates over half of its revenues in the Southeast Asia. RELX generates a large portion of its revenues out in America. So these are multinational businesses. And yes, there's a short-term benefit from the currency depreciation, which we've seen over the last year or so. But we don't rely on currency for long-term growth. We're going to look at the underlying businesses and their competitive advantages.
Sure. Let's talk about Unilever a bit more as we get into some stock specifics, or rather sector specifics, because we, as it happens, are writing on consumer staples probably around the time this podcast will be published. And in Global Income, you mentioned Unilever, Reckitt, Procter & Gamble, to, you know, look at the US equivalent, perhaps, is in there too. Nestle, you know, you've got a good selection of consumer staples there. Looking at their relative merits, is that something you do? You know, you hold them all, clearly you see them all as having particular value. But what's the attraction, first of all, of the sector? And then maybe if we can start talking about some of the relative merits of each individual company.
I think that as a sector, and looking at the branded consumer goods sector, if you think back to those qualities that we like, you find them there. So if you look at the cash generating ability of these companies, it's very good, and it's been proven to be very good through thick and thin over not just many years, but many decades. I mean, we've been managing the Global Income portfolio now for the Evelo Global Income portfolio for 5 years, which is, I guess, a relatively long period of time in one sense, but economic cycles happen over much, much longer timeframes than that. And these companies have been operating for, you know, for hundreds of years in the case of P&G and Unilever. So they have been proven to be able to respond to the economic environment through time, generate attractive cash flows, and really importantly, reinvest in their businesses and evolve their businesses through time. Because, you know, the Unilever and the Procter & Gamble of today is quite different to the Procter & Gamble and Unilever of yesteryear, and actually even in the recent past.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, what's been remarkable with the consumer branded goods companies so far this year is their ability to pass price through. And this comes back to the point Ben was making to a degree about the brand strength that they have. If you look at companies like Pepsi, they've been passing sort of mid-teens price increases through, which certainly something you wouldn't have imagined a couple of years ago when we were all talking about sort of deflationary pressures, particularly in Europe. Now, there are obviously difficult times coming up. You look at the amount of money available to consumers, it's going to be tricky. But we really believe that the businesses with high quality brands, where it's a highly differentiated product, so your Pepsis or your Coca-Colas, should be able to maintain that pricing power for a significant period.
Yeah, I was going to discuss that. As you say, you know, some of the pass-through rates have been very high, very strong in terms of being able to pass those costs on. You look at the analyst community, obviously, and they're constantly fretting about, you know, the next shoe to drop. Q3 results were nonetheless quite good for all these companies, Procter & Gamble, Unilever, Reckitt. And yet, you know, there's always a suspicion that the feared, from the perspective of shareholders in these companies, the feared shift to private labels could be coming through as cost of living pressures bite. How do you sort of assess these companies on that basis? Obviously, they all talk a good game, but I think even now, you know, management are still quite insistent they're not really seeing that much substitution, which is quite surprising when you compare the price of a jar of Hellmann's mayonnaise versus a supermarket owned brand and things like that. I mean, is it just a case of waiting to see what happens, or are there things you can do to look at how that might play out in the months ahead?
Yeah, I mean, certainly you want to keep monitoring the amount of marketing, particularly marketing to sales for these companies. You want them to keep investing even through sort of tough times. It is interesting because an inflationary environment isn't necessarily always great for private label. If you think about the proportion of the costs to the price ratio for each of these products, for a private label, generally, there isn't a lot of room to absorb increases in costs. So as you get the increase in costs, the price has to increase. Whereas with premium products with high gross margins, generally you can absorb the cost with a smaller increase.
And Unilever specifically, obviously there's been a lot of, talk this year on various issues, whether it be its ESG approach, obviously the bid for what is now Haleon. You know, it started the year in quite a difficult position with shareholders, but the operational performance, as we say, has been quite good. It's now got a sort of a restructure of its organization in terms of the way it discloses performance, things like that. At the same time, you know, we might have a new chief exec next year as well. What's your view of the company kind of structurally, operationally? Do you think some of those criticisms at the start of the year were, you know, it's kind of showing that it is actually in a good place now, or do you think some of those were justified?
Yeah, I think certainly when it comes to the Haleon bid, we were not supportive of that. And we're pleased that the shareholders, and it wasn't just us, were listened to. And I think that's now water under the bridge. I think that the long-term picture for Unilever is good, and it's had its operational challenges, but it's much simplified now that it's got rid of the dual-headed structure that it had with being part headquartered in the Netherlands and part in the UK, and is able to evolve its portfolio. And it has been doing portfolio actions that do seem sensible for the long term of the business. And I can draw a parallel actually with Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble, if you go back 5 or 6 years, had quite a similar problem. It did need to rationalize its portfolio. It disposed of a number of its sort of tail brands to a business called Coty. And at the time, there was a lot of commentary which is quite similar to the commentary we're hearing about Unilever in terms of, you know, is it able to, you know, grow and prosper into the future? And you look at what's happened to Procter & Gamble since then, it's certainly been able to. Now, the past for a different company is no guarantee of the future for Unilever, of course. But we do think that they're taking sensible strategic actions. And the long-term picture with, as Chris said, you know, some very strong emerging market presence where, yes, emerging markets can be volatile, but they certainly are growth markets over time. You know, that sets it up in a reasonably good place, I think.
Do you think they're investing enough in their business? That has been a criticism of Unilever in the past. Chris mentioned, you know, looking at things like marketing to sales, R&D to sales as well. Obviously, you know, they still lag the likes of Procter & Gamble on those metrics a little bit. Do you think they recognise that they need to do more there? Do they need to do more there?
Yeah, I think that we have spoken to the company in detail about this, and also very importantly, you know, as you say, the company can always talk a good game. We do speak to experts in the industry independently from the company as well. When it comes to things like marketing and sales, there is no magic number, but we can monitor spend in absolute terms relative to sales through time to get a sense of whether we feel like there's a significant risk to the business of underinvestment, and we feel. We feel as far as it's possible to tell that the picture is okay at the current time.
Sure. The final point on staples in general before we spread it out a little bit more is next year, you know, food price inflation is still rampant, frankly. You know, the companies are saying there's still a decent amount to come in the first half of next year as well in terms of price growth and the need to pass that on. At the same time, we are seeing right now, you know, some commodity prices potentially peaking, which could provide a tailwind for margins next year. Is that something you expect to come through relatively rapidly, or is it too hard to say still at this stage?
Yeah, I think what we are starting to see is some light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the input cost inflation pressure that companies have seen, consumer goods companies in particular, but by no means just consumer goods companies. And we are starting to hear comment that the companies do buy their inputs forward by some months, in some cases years, but so it takes time for these movements to feed through into the margin structure of businesses. So we are hearing tentative signs that yes, those input cost inflation pressures are easing, and also other things like supply chain difficulties. You know, a lot of I think input cost inflation has come from people paying up to secure supply, as much as the sort of market price of agricultural commodities, say. So with transportation costs coming down, supply chains easing a bit, and the headline and the sort of headline rates of price increase in commodities ameliorating, you know, that does paint a slightly more benign picture from that point of view, at least. So we'll see how it pans out, and it's very much light at the end of the tunnel rather than being here and now, but it does seem to be easing a bit.
Yeah, I'd say just as a sort of caveat, slightly, the only thing we are seeing is increased wage inflation. So, as Ben said at the beginning, there's always something. But these are businesses that are very good at managing their cost base and, as we said, can pass price through to customers.
Let's talk now about a different kind of company, the largest holding in the Global Income Fund at the last disclosed position at the end of August, I mean, the end of October, rather, is Microsoft. Now, obviously, the consumer staples are, you know, compounders, slow, steady growth. Microsoft, while being a well-established business, has been seeing significant growth, particularly in cloud computing, it's Azure service. Yet at the same time, you know, it is a tech company. Tech companies have obviously struggled a bit this year, and we have started to see signs of a slowdown in that growth. It sounds silly to say that when, you know, I think in the third quarter results, Azure was still growing at 33% year on year, but that was 2 percentage points lower than analysts thought. So, you know, there's a little bit of wariness there, and Microsoft has said that that growth is starting to come back a little bit. How do you see that as your biggest company? Are you happy with the performance this year? Are you wary of what might be coming down the line? You know, we are going through obviously a difficult time economically, and even in the US, looking like things might get a little bit more difficult. Are you wary about that cloud story and the such high expectations there and the need to constantly meet them? How do you view the company?
Sure. This one. So for Microsoft, cloud and Azure has become an increasingly big part of the business. To be still growing at 33% is incredible. And at the scale that it currently is, that sort of rate of growth has always got a limited amount of lifespan. You just can't be an elephant and run fast. To be honest, that said, the projections all the way up to 2030 are very good. And the short-term disruption that we're seeing in cloud is generally about businesses using cloud more efficiently and effectively, particularly in scaling their usage. And this is very sensible for Microsoft because it frees up additional capacity to increase sales to new customers.
The fund's biggest position, it wasn't at the start of the year. And actually, the relative performance of Microsoft, which has been weak this year, along with a lot of the other technology names very famously, has actually meant that we have built back into the position, having been reducing it through 2021, where the share price had been very strong. And this is our valuation discipline in action, actually. So we do, as I said, evolve the portfolio through time. We call it the portfolio nudge. And this is matching up our fundamental belief of being long-term investors in businesses is usually the right thing to do, provided you've selected the right businesses under our strategy. But things do change in the market, and you know, even the best business can be the wrong investment at the wrong price. So we do evolve the portfolios through time, and Microsoft is a good example where we had been reducing the position because it had been relatively very strong. The relative valuation was okay, but it wasn't certainly wasn't as appealing as it had been sort of a couple of years ago. And now that has reversed, and we're very happy to move with the market if that's where the market goes. So I think that the market does have some concerns about the broader technology sector. As you say, there are some things about Microsoft, but I think that, you know, Microsoft is a company that is extremely profitable. It's extremely cash generative. It can use that cash to reinvest in itself, which is great, and fend off the competition. It's likely to become essentially a duopoly with Amazon Web Services in the world of cloud computing. And that's not a bad place to be for the long term. So yes, there may be some shorter term wobbles in the growth rate, but the growth, as Chris said, over certainly the medium term, looks pretty good.
You mentioned Amazon there, and obviously when it comes to cloud, the big three: Microsoft, Amazon, Google. But your investment case for Microsoft, I presume, is based on, you know, the fact that it has a strong position in any number of sectors, not just cloud. I mean, is that the reason you hold it so, or certainly hold it a larger position than the likes of Google and Amazon? Obviously, they too have many strings to their bow, but there must be something about Microsoft that has particularly got you interested. The cash generation, as you say, as well, must be crucial from your point of view. And
absolutely. And I think you're right that it does have these other segments, you know, Windows, Xbox, etc., where they are in and of their own right good cash generative businesses. But the Windows business is not going to be as fast growth as the Azure business. You know, it's a very mature part of its portfolio, although it has been growing still. But I think that's defied expectations. We've been long term investors in Microsoft actually since since the early days of Evernote Income. So over a decade invested in the company, not just in the global income portfolio. And it's amazing. It shows that what can happen if a business that has a great competitive position in what it does, lots of cash, is willing to reinvest in itself. And I think, you know, not all businesses will be as extreme as Microsoft. And we certainly didn't predict Azure and the dominance that it would have. But it does show what can happen when reinvestment happens in a well-capitalized, well-organized company.
Let's talk about portfolio structure for a little bit. Microsoft, as you say, you know, is a dividend payer, obviously. It's still a pretty low yielder. You're, as mentioned, focused on dividend growth rather than absolute yield. But in an environment, you know, where, say, bond rates are rising, you know, base rates are rising, you know, the dividend growth, obviously the growth in that payout is crucial for yourselves. But do you find yourself thinking we need a higher starting yield in some cases, perhaps? Do you ever consider that starting yield being crucial, or is it all about, you know, the ability to grow perhaps from a low level but consistently and over years at a time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that we don't target a particular yield. I mean, to be part of the global income sector, one has to yield more than the MSCI World, which is not a particularly high benchmark to jump over. But we do. It's a little bit of a premium to the MSCI World. But you're right. The it's really the characteristics of the company that mean it can pay a dividend and a growing dividend. That's what we're more interested in. And then we are valuing those businesses over a long-term stream of cash flows that they might generate. And some of that will be coming back as a dividend today. And when it comes to portfolio construction, you know, we're really looking for diversification, you know, certainly by sector, by business model. And also that tends to mean, given the valuation environment at any given time, we have a mixture of some companies like Microsoft, which yield, you know, maybe one a bit, to some companies that yield more. And we've already talked about some of the consumer goods companies where they're yielding 2-3% plus. And we're happy, you know, we're happy with both of those ends of the spectrum. Where we don't really go to is the higher yields. So where you've got very limited scope for growth in those distributions through time. That's not really what we're interested in under our strategy. So the yield is important. And yes, in a rising rate environment, arguably becomes more important. And you know, all we do is invest in equities, so I don't have to worry about this so much. But clearly, if one is looking at a multi-asset portfolio, if you're looking at your asset allocation, with yields on government debt and yields on cash being basically zero for such a long time, you had to go somewhere else if you wanted any return. Now you don't, and so clearly, cash and other things like government bonds are more attractive than they were, and we have to accept that. But we look at valuation of equities in very much an absolute way, and rather than relative to other assets. And certainly we see the valuations that are available today, whether you're looking at yields or whether you're looking at cash flow, free cash flow, discounted cash flow models, you know, the valuations actually look attractive. And one final point I'd make is that why is it that I like investing in equities? Why do I have my savings in equities? Why am I an equity? Why am I an equity portfolio manager? Why do I do this as a job? And well, aside from it being absolutely fascinating, is that, you know, I get to go and meet companies around the world and ask them what they're doing, why they do it, who their customers are, how's it going, you know, and that is really, really, really interesting. But from a sort of purely investment point of view, these companies, they operate in the real world. They're real assets that deal with things like inflation and all these other things that we worry about. And if you look at equities as an asset class, even through the inflationary times of the 1970s, 1980s, you actually generated real returns from equities through those times. And that's not something that can be said for all asset classes. So that's something I like about equities. There are downsides, of course. You have to put up with volatility. But equities in general, but also these dividend paying and these dividend growers in particular, where we're managing through our process a lot of fundamental risk that one might take. That's both from a business point of view, things like balance sheets, that sort of thing. But then also we manage valuation risk as well. What we've observed, and we've just been through the 5-year anniversary, as you kindly mentioned at the start, of the Evelo Global Income portfolio, what we've observed actually is by managing those risks, what we see in terms of the performance profile of the fund is a profile which has delivered good returns, but particularly when you take into account the risks that have been taken. So if you look at the things like the drawdown of the fund, the volatility of the fund, the beta of the fund, whatever your chosen risk statistic is, they all look quite favourable compared to the general market. And that's something that I quite like about our strategy, if you're managing risks as well as looking for returns.
On a purely statistical basis, when you're looking at companies and valuations, do you have certain levels at which, you know, you don't want to get involved, whether that be, you know, dividend cover, whether it be debt, whether it be, you know, something else entirely? Can it be broken down? Can it be screened in that way in terms of how you start looking for companies to add to the portfolio? Or is it all pretty much on a case-by-case basis?
I mean, you could certainly screen them. We are relatively debt averse. I think if you compare the debt on the portfolio to its benchmark, the MSCI World, we're comfortably below. But it is worth remembering that different businesses have different tolerances. So the amount of debt a Unilever can take is completely different to the level, say, a recruiter or a more cyclical business can take. Now, in terms of sort of what are the knockout screening characteristics that we look at, the most important is return on invested capital. It's, are these businesses getting a good return on the investments that they're making over the long term?
When we look at the cyclical sectors, you mentioned recruiters there, you know, there are some cyclical stocks trading on pretty high yields now, as tends to be the case in difficult times. Have you considered this year, you know, looking at companies which have been, you know, bombed out a little bit, you know, as long as the ROIC is still looking quite good, they might be actually trading on quite a high yield, for example, but there might be some value there and there might be a business that has been under-recognized. Have you been able to take advantage of perceived opportunities like that this year? Or has it been a case that, you know, the kind of quality stock that you focus on is never going to be hurt as much as more cyclical parts of the market?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think that there is, to come back to this point, there is always something to do, even in our narrower subset of, we define quality in a particular way, and there is always something to do. So if you think about the additions to the portfolio more recently, and I mentioned Experian, you know, this is a company that is pretty stable. You know, it does have some economic sensitivity, so it is somewhat dependent on mortgage applications. Mortgage applications have gone down recently, so there is a little bit of cyclicality there. But actually, most of its revenue is recurring because it sells its services as a sort of package to banks, for which they pay, you know, a fixed price, and then there is some transactional volume on top of that. And I think that's where it gets interesting for us, because where for whatever reason the market is worried about the company, but we see the long-term picture as being pretty stable, then that's an opportunity. So I think, you know, Experian is an example of that. If I think back a little bit further in time, we invested in a completely different sector, LVMH, towards the back end of last year, and we've been building into the position as we've gone through this year, and the stock has been relatively weak. So this is a luxury goods giant. The outlook for that over the sort of medium to long term is very good, but there are these worries that come along. So the initial worry when we invested last year was that the Chinese Communist Party had made some noises that were taken to mean increased taxations on the wealthy. That turned out not to be the case, but, you know, maybe that would have happened. But did that dent the long-term demand profile for Louis Vuitton? Probably not. You know, did it? Are people going to be buying more or less Moët in 5 years' time? There's some good demand profile for these businesses. So where you do have these worries that are shorter term in nature, that does create some interesting opportunities sometimes.
Another sector which you have a little bit of exposure is advertising. You know, Omnicom, I think in the past you've had Publicis, WPP, companies like that as well. This seems like an interesting area to me insofar that these companies, again, looking at Q3s, things like that, haven't been voicing much concern about the environment, which is perhaps contrary to what you might think at the moment. You know, we're seeing other companies maybe more focused on digital advertising, you know, sounding the alarm a little bit, but the giants so far seem quite stable. Are you still comfortable with that sector? Do you think there's inevitably going to be a slowdown in you know, certainly in revenue growth, things like that coming up, or do you think they can continue to hold the line?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the more cyclical parts of the portfolio. We prefer the majority of the portfolio to be in relatively less economically sensitive businesses, so that will always be the bedrock of the portfolio. But where there are companies that can generate good returns through the cycle, then there's a place for those at the right valuation. So yeah, we do hold Omnicom and Publicis. So Publicis is the French version. And yeah, so far they have been reporting relatively robust demand for their services. And I think that there is an interesting dynamic that's been at play over many, many years, which is that the rise of digital advertising and sort of omni-channel advertising, which is only more and more complicated. This picture doesn't get less complicated through time. And then you throw into, you know, things like what's happening at Twitter, you know, how do companies navigate that? You know, the role of a valued and a knowledgeable third party to help companies navigate this complex environment, I think it remains and increases through time. But there will be cyclicality in advertising spending. But yeah, but you're right, that hasn't really been seen yet by these companies. But I don't think that means it's not going to happen. So yeah, we do monitor that. But they do look good value. And they are another interesting example of companies that have had to evolve their business model. And there's a theme here. All businesses have to do this. You know, there is no business that can just say, this is the job done, and we'll just sit here and do what we're doing year in, year out. You know, these companies have had to engage in digital advertising, figure out how they're going to have a value proposition for their customers. In the case of Publicis, they bought a company called Sapient in the world of digital consulting. They also bought a company called Epsilon in the world of digital data and analysis. And so they have a very well-stocked cupboard of digital capability for helping their customers, and not forgetting that the customers still want to advertise on TV, if you can imagine such an old-fashioned thing.
Clearly, quality, you know, as you can see from the portfolios, tends to lead to a focus on large caps. You know, the focus on cash flow often means, you know, looking at the very biggest companies. Small caps, you know, how readily can you find, you know, good cash flow, the kind of companies you look for in the small cap area, especially with a focus on quality nowadays? Are there still opportunities there for the small cap quality investor that you're taking advantage of?
Yeah, well, I think you certainly can find small companies that fit the bill. But we tend to look at mid and large caps, and you know, we manage, if you look at the Evelode Income Fund, it's actually soft closed, because you know, I think that when you get into those smaller companies, you know, liquidity can be a challenge.
Sure.
And so, you know, I think that it's, you know, there's a better structure through which to do that investing. But certainly I think there are lots of small cap companies that are out there that are cash generative, that are really good, dominant in their niche. Often they often have a niche, and I think in the UK we do niche engineering quite well, for example. But actually within our strategies, you don't see that so much, because these are open-ended funds. So yeah, I probably shouldn't comment too much more, and leave that to dedicated managers who are experts.
All right, I was trying to sucker you in for some interest for the small cap listeners out there, but we'll save that for another day. Let's turn back to the bigger companies then. We touched on right at the beginning when we were talking about Staples. We touched on Unilever and its bid for Haleon. The flip side of that deal is, of course, GSK, who have now divested their consumer business. You hold GSK, I think, in both funds, last I checked.
That's right.
Again, that's another interesting large cap stock to my mind, in that, you know, there's potentially, you know, some good news coming through after maybe a period of, in which, you know, its drug portfolio has struggled to deliver a huge amount of winners. You may disagree with that assessment, but what's your sort of view on the story for GSK and its ability to, you know, produce those blockbuster drugs? And then also, if we come on to the kind of litigation which has weighed on the shares in recent weeks and months as well.
Yeah, shall I kick off with a sort of headline on the Haleon thing, and then I know Chris has some thoughts on the pharma sector and investment as well. So, but yeah, I think the spin-off of Haleon was a good thing, because I think it brings focus to the pharmaceutical portfolio. I think that and I know that Chris will come on to this, but the level of debt that the GlaxoSmithKline had was a bit of a hindrance. So putting that into the more stable business that is Haleon, which is a consumer healthcare business, does make sort of sense from an operational strategic place. And I think it is now better placed than it has been historically to move forward and move on with its product development. But yeah, Chris, I know you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, just under the current regime, they have dramatically reduced the number of trials that they're running. And that focus that you see, not only in removing the consumer branded goods part of the business, but even within the drug development portfolio, is very, very welcome. Now, the vaccines business has also done very well recently, particularly with Shingrix, which obviously had a slight pause while everyone was getting their COVID vaccines. But overall, there are sort of green shoots in terms of the drug development, and it does look like Glaxo have really understood the focus that is needed to have a good portfolio developing over time. And part of that really is down as well to not over-distributing. And this comes back to the idea of dividend and dividend growth. Glaxo, for quite a while, in our opinion, were distributing perhaps a little bit too much and potentially could have cut the dividend earlier. Now, this might seem unusual for an income fund to say we really value the amount of reinvestment that Glaxo have done since they have cut the dividend. And I think that is where you're seeing a lot of the brightness in their future come from.
And on the point of, you know, potential litigation, again, we've seen the share price fall a little bit in the summer when this story came out that had been there for a while, but no one had noticed, it seemed, or some shareholders hadn't noticed, and now there's some worries there. How do you sort of view that?
Yeah, this is not in many ways not new news. As you say, I think it's been ongoing since about 2018. So, but suddenly the market seemed to wake up to it. Yeah, we've analysed the issue, and certainly it's very complicated to start with, because the rights to Zantac have been sort of passed around from sort of pharmaceutical company to pharmaceutical company. So GlaxoSmithKline, we also hold Sanofi, who have held the right, who actually were the last holders to the rights to Zantac, and discovered the issue, which is that it may have been contaminated with a small quantity of a potential carcinogen. So you can see by all the caveats that I used in the previous sentence that there's a lot of uncertainty around whether there is actually an issue or not. Now, clearly, the plaintiffs in various class action lawsuits which have been brought think there is. From our reading of it, and we have done some research around this, as you can imagine, there is the potential for there to be a claim. The value that has been attributed to it by the share price declines, which you've noted, seem to be way out of line with any potential litigation cost, ultimately. That's not to diminish that there might be a tail risk that there's a larger liability there, but it seems that the potential litigation is manageable in most scenarios to us.
Let's move on and maybe conclude by looking at Europe. You mentioned at the start from the global fund's perspective that over time you've been shifting a little bit more into Europe, perhaps away from the US. The European equity market, you know, it's always unloved, much like the UK, I suppose. But from the UK investors' point of view, it's not somewhere they tend to dip feet too often. Can you maybe say a little bit about the kind of company that you're finding interesting in Europe? We've touched on, obviously, some of them, such as the ad companies and LVMH, but what kinds of businesses are you finding there?
Yeah, I mean, I think Europe's a really interesting market, because I think it's a big market, obviously, in its totality, but everyone kind of focuses on the sort of high growth end of the US market, and that's what gets everyone very excited. There are some interesting businesses there, of course, but actually in Europe you do have some really, really great businesses, and it's amazing what can happen when you have a nice, steadily growing business that, again, reinvests in its business and is willing to move its product portfolio on. So over the last 5 years that we've been managing the Evelo Global Income Fund, the top contributor to our performance is a Dutch business-to-business media company called Wolters Kluwer. And Wolters Kluwer is in the sweet spot of what we look for at Evelo. And actually, I didn't know until we'd done the analysis. I was just looking at the numbers this morning, actually, that it was our top contributor. But it's a business that we very much like because it does tick all those boxes. It's great in its niche. It's cash generative. It's been willing to reinvest and invest in evolving its portfolio. So if you go back 20, 25 years, it was predominantly a print publisher of information. And now it's a vast majority of its portfolio, well over 90%, is digital, and it's delivering data, analytics, and software to help its customers manage their practices in various different industries. So it's got a business that deals with governance, risk, and compliance, so banks and that sort of thing, legal business, tax and accounting, and also a healthcare business. So if you're a healthcare practitioner in a hospital, you might be using a software package called UpToDate, which gives the latest science on the various maladies that your patients might be walking into the hospital with. And all of these things, they are the relatively small cost compared to like the cost of running a hospital. But they can be really, really important in determining, in the healthcare example, patient outcomes. And that's what really matters to a hospital, is getting patients in, getting them sorted, and getting them out again. It's really a great example of the sort of business that I think Europe does really well. Don't necessarily get the pulses racing, when you're thinking about the kind of hot, really sexy end of technology. But actually, this is an app. They're applying the technology in domains with deep domain expertise, and that's where their kind of competitive edge lies. So I do talk about Wolters Kluwer quite a lot because it's a great example of what we're looking for in businesses. But it also shows, it's not a fast grower. It grows in the mid single digits. But it grows in mid-single digits like a clock. And that can add up to some really nice things through time.
Is that, the European exposure has been increasing. You look ahead to next year now, we're almost there. It seems horrifying to say, but it is the end of November as we record this. Do you anticipate, European opportunities continuing to take up or to account for more of a fund, or is it maybe a case of now that the US market has struggled a bit this year that you're starting to look back there globally?
It's a good question, and I think that we obviously don't know what's going to happen next year, but tentatively this year what we have been seeing is, I mean, we've already talked about Microsoft, but the technology sector more broadly, which is focused on the US, in terms of where the companies are listed, that is where we've been seeing some better value opportunities. So from Microsoft, yes, but Accenture as well, which has come off reasonably heavily this year. I think that the pendulum started to swing the other way. We don't know whether it might get stuck or will continue on that path. But certainly, it's not. The US has been weak, but actually parts of the European market have been very weak as well. So there is still opportunity there. So we'll be selective and see what it means on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, but you would expect us to make sort of gradual changes at the company-by-company level anyway. So we're not going to suddenly switch half the portfolio over to the US.
Sure.
Unlikely.
You never know. Never say never. But speaking of that kind of changes, one final point on developing markets, which we haven't touched on in terms of domicile, at least, that's still a very small part of the global income portfolio. A lot of people like to talk up the opportunities in dividend stocks globally. For you, has it just been a question of not finding opportunities that are good enough to bump out the kind of well-known or at least developed market names? Or are you still looking and still keen to get more developing exposure if you can?
Yeah, we do look, and we certainly wouldn't be averse to investing in emerging market listed companies should the right ones come along. I think that the fact is there are two kind of twin challenges. The first is, as you say, the incumbents that we have that are developed market listed they do business in emerging markets, and Chris mentioned it earlier, for the consumer goods sector and other businesses like RELX. But you know, if you look at the underlying revenues of the portfolio, about 20% comes from Asia Pacific. So, and you know, probably somewhere in the high single digits of that is from China. A bit hard to estimate, but that sort of level. So yeah, we are getting exposure to those geographies, but through Western listed. We have one Asia Pacific holding, but it's an Australian listed business called Sonic Healthcare. But what you get from that is that exposure, but also with kind of Western grade corporate governance, and that's really important. So we have looked at other markets like India. I mean, the Indian IT outsourcing market is pretty interesting. China, clearly, we've done some thematic work on that and other geographies as well. But the difficulty is that there are some pretty significant corporate governance challenges. And then when you're looking at Chinese listed businesses, you've got the geopolitics there, or the politics, if you're looking at just the domestic economy, which is a challenge, I think. But you know, do we need to have those businesses? No, not at the current time. Would we like to have them in time if it made sense? Absolutely. So we will keep on looking.
Thank you for that and for all your thoughts today. It's been a great discussion, but we have come to the end of our time now. So I would like to say thank you to the listeners as well for sticking with us, and to Ben and to Chris for taking part. We'll see you next time on another IC Interviews podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.